No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to us at BBSRADIO and the number 1. Tonight we have a special guest, Ken Ferber. He's the CEO and founder of Truify. They tell you how to develop a unique personal brand and how to protect your reputation on social media. And as somebody that represents the District of Columbia, which often has a bad reputation, I can't wait to talk to this guy. Maria,
well, and who doesn't need? I am, Michael. First of all, happy birthday to you. How was it?
Oh, thank you. I'm the oldest guy in America now.
Oh, you stop.
But thank you. And thank you to all those people on Facebook. Before I forget, over 100 people on Facebook wished me a happy birthday. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Very nice. And we're also having Ken on the program, too, because he had a trip that was somewhat poignant, seminal, and really pivotal in his life about the Holocaust and some of the concentration camps. So he's going to share a little bit with us about that as well. So I know we're having troubles with Skype, and we're having troubles with him with Skype, but I think we're going to get him on cell phone.
Good. And I can't wait to talk about that either, because as you may or may not know, Maria, when they opened the Holocaust Museum, it was my communications firm that did all the communications work around opening the Holocaust Museum. So it's something
I didn't know a little bit about.
Yeah, that I know a little bit about secondhand. And, I was the guy that did all the printed communications and stuff for the Park Service. About $500,000 worth of work when they opened the Holocaust Museum. So, you know, we had to go over all the material and decide what to put out and what not to put out. And it was an amazing experience. It's just I'm anxious to talk to Ken about his experience. I'm sure it was life-changing.
Well, I went to visit. I have a girlfriend who lives on Capitol Hill in D.C., and we had worked together with this organization. It was called at the time Women Travel for Peace. Now they've renamed it. But we went on a trip to Senegal, and we were having a reunion. So I stayed with her, and she says, would you like to go to the Holocaust Museum? I was like, sure. She goes, you know, prepare for at least 2 hours. And I thought, 2 hours? Oh, my gosh, I don't know if I can take that much time to see and to dwell and to, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm sticking my head in my sand, but I just thought it was going to be such a bummer that that would be the most. Well, we got there at 11, and they kicked us out when they closed, which I think is at 5 or 5:30. It was riveting and compelling and depressing and, you know, mortifying and everything else that we know it to be. But, yeah, I was overwhelmed and overcome.
And, you know, the thing for me, Maria, was not only that, it's just as you say, it's overwhelming when you see all this stuff, like the Room of Shoes. I don't know if you remember that, but where they would take the people's shoes and collect them. But not only is it overwhelming and, like you say, depressing, but it's hard to think of how inhuman it yeah. all was, how terrible we can be to one another, and the fact that you and I mean, maybe not you, but certainly me, I'm old enough to remember my father fought in the Second World War. My father was actually a liberator. He was, which is a title they gave to people that liberated concentration camps. And he was a communications guy who went into one of the worst concentration camps when it was liberated in Poland. So, you know, these are not distant memories. That's the thing, too. It really wasn't that long ago. It was 75 years ago that all this took place.
Did your dad talk to you about what he did and what he saw?
He only did it one. He only talked to me about it one time, and he was very. He really didn't even talk about the war very much. You know, it was a bad experience for him. He went all. He was in the European theater for the entire war, and he talked to me about the concentration camp that he liberated one time, and he said it was just horrible. It was horrible that you could 100 miles away you could smell it. You know, that ash covered everything. That he saw full grown men that weighed 40 and 50 pounds. You know, he just, you know, and the one time he talked about it, and he said, yeah, it was a terrible experience on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, you were happy that you had saved these people.
I have a girlfriend, her mom is an identical twin, and they both were in at least 6 concentration camps, and they're still alive. And they work with UCLA in their World War II class, specifically about the Holocaust. And I had the pleasure of interviewing them this year for a class of mine in the master's program. And their stories are, and being identical twins and them slipping past Goebbels when he was doing
right.
those twin studies.
Right, they had those terrible experiments.
Yeah, and he, so what they, the people who saw them, first of all, they had gotten dressed separately the day they got rounded up, so they weren't dressed identically as they usually were. Second of all, when people saw them, they separated them by 5 or 6 in the line so that he wouldn't see one face and then the other. And that's how they got spared the identical twin study test, because he was there when they arrived.
Well, you know, one of the great projects of the Holocaust Museum, which was paid for by Steven Spielberg, is that they took people like the women that you're talking about and started interviewing them. And they have, you know, literally thousands of hours of tapes of interviewing people like that. I wouldn't be surprised if your friends were part of that project, because Spielberg realized after he'd done that movie, Schindler's List, that these people were dying. That you know they had reached the age, and that their story was going to be lost. He was afraid their story would be lost, and so he went and he immortalized them by capturing these interviews. And what a brilliant idea that was!
And they've also been honored here in Los Angeles at the museum. In fact, they were honored with a group of folks when unveiled their photographs, and I was invited to that ceremony, and the room had, I don't know, I want to say about 2 dozen people in it, because these gals just turned 90 last year. So we are talking, you know, living history, not to mention the fact that they're identical twins.
Yes, which is amazing in itself that they survived. And I should tell you one more story, and that is that I worked my way through college by working for what was the number one men's clothier in Washington. And we had a guy who was a Holocaust survivor, and he was our tailor. And he had, I believe, 4 or 5 sisters, and he and his father were spared, and all of his sisters and his mother were put to death. And the reason they were spared is, even though he was a little boy, he was being trained to be a tailor, and the Nazis like to have their suits tailored. So, like to have their uniforms tailored. So they kept him and his father lived through the whole war. And this guy, they brought him to the White House to, and this would work, this would fit in right to what Ken does. They brought him to the White House because Gerald Ford, they said, didn't know how to dress, and so his people came into breeches one day, and they bought like 10 suits for him. And of course, the President of the United States doesn't stop by for a fitting. You actually go to him. So we sent this tailor, and he fitted the suits, and Ford gave him a picture of, you know, of the two of them in the Oval Office, and it was signed to him. Well, this man carried that picture in a frame everywhere he went. He brought it to work every day, and when we would have our annual parties, he would come and he would carry the picture. And because he was so honored that he had gone from being in a concentration camp to actually meeting the President of the United States and doing something for the President of the United States.
It was
really lovely thing.
That's a story.
He had the numbers on his arm.
We have Ken on the line, too.
Okay, good. Ken, are you with us?
I am hopefully with you.
Yeah.
Hey, Ken.
We hear you loud and clear. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I was listening to your story about the pants, the tailor, and I found myself at lunch in Memphis a couple of years ago sitting next to a gentleman whose name was Hager. And as you probably know, he was the Hager on the end of the phone call with LBJ, who was describing the need for extra fabric in certain parts of his pants in language that only LBJ could use.
Well, you know, and that's a long tradition in clothes, Ken. You know that we all leave the bottom button of our vest open because Henry VIII was too fat to close his.
I had no idea.
They were not. Yeah, so people were not, so they would not offend him. Everybody left the bottom button open like it was a style thing, and we still do it to this day. But it's great to have you on.
So, Ken, before we share with our listeners about your launching Truify, because obviously we're interested in what you're going to be doing, just not only professionally but personally, I was sharing with the senator about your epiphany that you had, and I don't know if that's the right word that you want to use, about your time with the concentration camps and what you discovered and what it means to you on a personal level and in a global level. Do you mind?
No, not at all. And epiphany is definitely one of the words I would use. I'm getting a little chill goosebumps here just thinking about it. My interest in the Holocaust goes back to when I was a young teenager, and I asked my parents, we're all from Eastern Europe, Ashkenazi Jews, why didn't anybody stop this when it was happening? And my mother said, well, that's because nobody knew. And at that age, this was the age of questioning, and I never bought that for a second, and I wanted to, and so I embarked upon this multi-decade study of my own to find out what we did know, when we did know it and such. And I've visited all the museums in this country and read dozens of books on it. And finally, it was time because of what's been going on in Germany, where the I'm not sure it's a resurgence, but this commitment of the German government, this incredible commitment of the German government to engage in very public acts of developing museums and memorials so that the German people, no matter where they are going to know about this, and this is not going to be hidden from them. And it's really an extraordinary thing that they've done in their country. And I thought that was a good time to finally go over there. And you could read all the books and you could see the museums, but when you actually set foot in a concentration camp, and it changes your whole perspective of the world.
So what did you learn that may have been different than what you were told?
Well, it wasn't as much as it was different. It was things I had not been aware of. One of the real, there were a few moments on the trip that, I took this by myself that I was not expected and wasn't prepared for. When I went on the full day at Auschwitz and Birkenau, and I was on this study tour, which was a 6-hour tour, and our little group of we went in, our guide took us aside, and because there were a lot of tours going on at the same time, And he just wanted, he said, I want to make sure everybody here knows this is the full day tour. And you're going to be in his camp for 3 hours. We're going to have a little break. And we'll take you over to the next camp. And you'll be there for 3 hours. And then you can stay as long as you want. And we all nodded. And he said, so you're here for 6 hours at least. And we all nodded. And he said, well, you're going to spend more time here than 80% of the Jews that ever came here.
Really?
And that was something I was unaware of, unprepared for, that the concept of what they have a different definition of what a Holocaust, an Auschwitz prisoner was. Because
how so?
The overwhelming majority were never in the camp itself. They were at the train at Birkenau, where the famous train stopped, and they were taken right to the gas chambers. And they were never registered as Auschwitz prisoners. You know, they didn't have the tattoos or anything. They had, but the records were kept in another place. But that was the overwhelming majority of the people never even stepped foot in Auschwitz. But they died at Auschwitz too.
My goodness, that's terrifying to hear that.
Yeah, it was. And when we got over to Birkenau, which is only a mile away, and Birkenau was the camp that was developed as the extermination camp. That's where you see all the famous pictures of the train lines and such. And what surprised me, one of the things that I was not prepared for, first of all, Birkenau is 20 times the size of Auschwitz. It's this massive camp. And how efficient, how many, there were five different, I think there were five different gas chamber and then oven, sets of ovens spread up all around the camp because they had to keep building new ones because they had more Jews were coming in than they could possibly kill on a single day. And this efficient machine that they were running of death was just astonishing to see how efficient it really was and how they were able to do what they did. And that surprised me greatly.
So were you with a study group, or how did you find yourself actually there with your boots on the ground?
They actually have, Auschwitz requires, for most of the year, Auschwitz requires that you're on a tour. And most of the tours are short morning, afternoon tours that give you just an overview of Auschwitz. But I signed up for this study tour where you're actually with somebody who's a scholar who studies this, and you see buildings that the other people don't see. You get insights that the other people don't get. A lot of the information, obviously, I'd known. But what really got me about Auschwitz and surprised me was, and this was true of everything I saw the whole trip, was how they did not try to, in any of the language, they did not try to hide anything. Once you get inside the gate at Auschwitz, there's a sign there, and it says, the corpses of prisoners shot while trying to escape were often displayed here as a warning to others. And so you're seeing these signs, but now you're standing there.
Right.
And that makes it completely different how real it was and how sophisticated a system was set up to do this.
Well, you know what? I'm sorry, Ken. I dropped off for a minute off the internet, but I'm back now. So if you've already covered this, I'm sorry. But that's the thing that really got to me when I worked on the opening of the Holocaust Museum here in Washington, was not only the great inhumanity that was involved, but the efficiency, you know, just like everything the Germans do, right? The cars they make, the cameras, they were just terribly efficient at it. And they killed so many people. It was just staggering to me.
And you think about the concept that there were people that this is what they did every day. At another measure of efficiency was that at Sachsenhausen, which is outside of Berlin, that was the first camp that was ever built. They found that the guards were having emotional problems shooting the prisoners, and they devised a way where the guard could actually shoot the prisoner without the prisoner knowing it, and he wouldn't see the prisoner's face either. It was through like a board, and they'd shoot it right into the prisoner's back of his head, because they were so concerned that their guards were having an issue with killing so many people. So they resolved that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I want to make this as clear as I possibly can. You walk around Berlin, and you're going to see amazing memorials. You're going to see signs. You're going to see everything that was involved there, because they want every. This is not hidden in some museum. This is really where they exist in the streets, where people can't avoid it. And so, you've got one of the most dynamic cities now, really having a core value of it being lessons of the Holocaust. And I think partially that's probably a lot more directed toward the German people than it is toward the visitors.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that bothers me, Ken, and maybe you're, as an image person, consultant, you can speak to this. But one of the things that bothers me as a liberal these days is how we're going back and trying to revise history in this country. We've just renamed Jeb Stuart High School here in Virginia. We're taking down statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. I think that's a dangerous thing to do. I think people need to remember, you know what I mean? Rather than be politically correct about everything, I think it's more important that we remember the Civil War and remember the causes of the Civil War and what transpired afterwards that led to the Civil Rights Movement. How do you feel about that, being in Germany as
well,
you were?
That is exactly my point with what Germany has done. The biggest memorial in the city is the blocks, these large blocks that are right in the center of Berlin. The sign that they use is, and I have it in front of me, is Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe. They use that very stark language everywhere. There's no couching of facts or using any words other than how many were killed and how many were murdered. And Germany's really taking the lead in that, because that's exactly, and by the way, everything they have there is in it's in German, in English, and in Hebrew.
Ken, as a historian, if you will, this journey that you've been on, what do you think caused the turnaround for them to, like, either, one, not accept responsibility, two, try to push it away, three, to try to put their heads in the ground, and then now four, coming full frontal?
Well, this started with the reunification, and that's where everything started, and that was a huge hindrance, because there really was not a unified Germany. And actually, most of where this is East Berlin. This is the new area of East Berlin. So they would never have done that. They didn't even rebuild the city at all. And I think it's just a lot of the leadership that is in Chancellor Merkel and the people there. I think it's also, Berlin now is a financial capital, so there's a business component to this as well. But, I want to say, though, that, and this is one of the conversations, I had lunch with the number two person in the German consulate here in Los Angeles recently, and we were talking about, because I had an incident happen to me that was uncomfortable, and I was sharing it with her, and one of the challenges that they can do everything they want, but they can't control all the people to do the right thing all the time. And in the Wall Street Journal 3 days ago, there is a story that I had never heard of, that there are 1.2 million volumes of books that the Nazis plundered and were sitting in train cars. So it's still going, and was sent to Russia for some reason. So there's still a lot of issues. The Munich Museum, there was an issue about returning artwork and to its rightful owner. They're still facing a lot of issues internally. And keep in mind, they're also facing tremendous pressures from their own people in terms of their right wing becoming, how they're dealing with refugees and such. But if you had asked me 15, 20 years ago, could they do this, I would have said no. And so it's to their credit that they're doing this, and it really is extraordinary. And people should go and see Berlin. Besides, it's a beautiful city, but to actually see how a country can deal with this, because without putting this in the forefront, you can't create a bridge of responsibility and forgiveness, because those are the two things that have to come into play. You know, growing up as I did, I despised everything German. I did not buy any German products. I would not talk to people of German heritage. I would meet people in business if they were from Germany. I didn't talk to them. And I developed this really horrible hatred of everything German, which was just absolutely wrong. So part of this also is allowing us to go through our own forgiveness for them, that the people that are there now, they had nothing to do with it. And, well, and we need to start building that bridge as well.
Well, and
that's,
you know, awesome.
Thing, of you.
The and, well, and it's, I think that's a very important point, Ken, because one of the things that I'm not sure younger people understand is that Germany was a democracy. It wasn't, yep. You know, it was a democracy. It was they had a proud heritage of you know, practicing democratic principles. So this is not something that's like could never happen again. It's not let's hope that things like this never happen again. But they certainly have gone on since the Second World War. We certainly have seen ethnic cleansing in the Middle East. Yeah. We've seen Pol Pot, you know, the terrible, terrible ethnic cleansing that went on in Asia. So, you know, that's another problem that I have with revisionist history. I think, you know, the old saying that those that don't learn from history are doomed to repeat
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
I'm sorry?
I was going to ask, what is your biggest takeaway about this amazing trip that you had, other than you'll have it for the rest of your life? Like, sharing it with your daughter.
Yeah, my number one takeaway is I'm going back. I can't wait to go back next year. I think that the number one takeaway was that, first of all, Poland, you know, I was only in Warsaw for a day and a half, but Krakow, which was the historical capital of Poland, is one of the most beautiful cities you could visit. And the people are terrific. And what's interesting is that Germany, which is regaining its Jewish population, it's still very German, as they say. Poland, which has not recovered its Jewish population, but the beauty of Krakow, and I never felt at risk. I never felt endangered in Poland. I never felt like that anybody was looking at me because I was Jewish or even an American at that point. The other takeaway that I had was that what was going on in Germany when I was there that week was the election, Theresa May's election in England. Mm-hmm. And nobody asked me about Donald Trump at all in 10 days. They were focused on what was going on in Britain. So they were very concerned about Brexit and how that's going to change their dynamic. And so they're really looking at the perspective of, as leadership in a democratic world. From the point of view of actually visiting the camps, and everything, I think it is. What got me was what I expected to be very emotional and difficult. Generally, was not. But then these moments would come up that absolutely overwhelmed me. And I'll tell you the single biggest moment. I had found out, I don't know, about a year or two ago, that there is a plaque at the old Jewish cemetery in Krakow that mentions. It's a tribute to the Ferber family, and I think it was 88 Jews of the Ferber family were killed. And I have no idea if that's us or anything, but I related to that, and I've studied that. And my first day there in Krakow, I went over to the Jewish cemetery right down the block, and I looked at the sign, which says, "In loving memory of the Ferber family, 88 members murdered by the Nazi Holocaust." And I reached up, and it's on this wall with a lot of other plaques and such. And I reached up with my hand to touch the plaque. And I know this sounds very surreal, and it really was. From my fingertips coming down my arm was this wave of sorrow. And it came down my arm into my chest, and I just broke down crying.
Did you?
I mean, I'm not sure if I could top that.
Yeah, I can believe that, Ken. And, you know, I'd also like to say that by preserving this history and understanding what really happened, there are also great, great stories of heroic actions on the part of individuals that were involved in saving Jews. We all know the story of Arthur Schindler, thanks to Steven Spielberg. But there are many others. Someone just posted on the internet the other day the story about a woman who was a plumber that the Nazis used. She was a Pole, I think, and they used her to do work in the sewers in the ghetto, and she snuck out 1,200 children in her tool bag, in her equipment. She would sneak them out, and when she was caught doing it, they broke both her arms and legs. She just passed away. But, you know, there were great stories of personal sacrifice and people who stand up in the face of overwhelming odds. I mean, you know, what courage it must have taken, given the horror and the scope of 6 million Jews being executed. You know, what courage it must have taken to stand up against that. But those are stories that can be forgotten too, and they shouldn't be.
There's a museum in Warsaw, which is this incredible new museum of the history of Jews in Poland for 1,000 years. And it's this award-winning new museum that actually puts you back in a shtetl 500 years ago, and you've got sights and sounds around you. It's almost like a Disney kind of quality. It's very educational, but it's also very entertaining and informative, and you see that. But they talk about what happened in Poland, that there were so many people that challenged it. They talked about that. One of the things that I found that was what was interesting was that in Krakow, which was the Jewish capital of Poland, so all the issues, all the signs with the Jewish world in Krakow are in English and Polish and Hebrew. You go a couple blocks the other way to the churches, which are magnificent, and everything is just in Polish. And I don't think they understand how valuable it would be to put this in English and other languages so people can understand the whole story themselves. So I think maybe Poland is still working on their version of this, because it is still not a country where Jews feel particularly safe or want to move there. Welcomed, I would say. Where Germany is, you know, one of the things that was interesting, and Americans know this about Germany, and it is true, about their absence of sense of humor and their seriousness. And there's a very big cultural difference that I discovered among the German people that and it's not has nothing to do with the war or Jews or anything. You don't go up to somebody in Germany and compliment them on a hat or a bag or something. That is just not done. I was having lunch with the woman from the consulate, and she was wearing this beautiful summer dress, and this in the restaurant this lady of a certain age came by and looked and said, "Ma'am, that's a beautiful dress." And the consulate said to me, "See, that would never happen in Germany." So there are things that also are very different that we're going to have to overcome at some point. But to look at the reality that what Germany is trying to do, which is unimaginable, to build a reputation that embraces their past. And I always think, with all due respect, Senator, imagine if the Americans did that regarding our history with Native Americans, that wherever you went in this country, you would see signs of how many died and how many were killed. So it's amazing what they're doing, and I hope they can continue this.
Well, you know, there's great inhumanity in that story, to Ken, you know, everything from Wright giving Indians blankets infected with smallpox, or the law that they had in California. It's hard to believe this because California is such a liberal state, but they had a law at one time where it was okay to go out and shoot Indians, you know, recreationally. I mean, yeah, they have had a horrible, horrible a path to trot as well. And just coincidentally, I work to train Native Americans that want to run for public office through a group called Indians List. And it's probably the thing I respect most about Native Americans is that although they've had this horrible, horrible treatment, they all have faith that tomorrow will be a better day. They still have great faith. They're loyal American citizens. And that's one of the things that people have to realize about Jews, too, is they were in Germany for 1,000 years. This wasn't an immigrant group that had come in at the, you know, they were as much a part of the fabric of German society as any particular group. So, and if it can happen there, I think,
going on that point, exactly, my mother has a friend, they've been friends forever, and she was Jewish, and she was in Germany, and they fled to Canada, like, right before it would become impossible to leave. And my mother told me that she would ask her, you know, why were you staying? You were Jewish, you knew what was going on. And she said, because we were Germans. We always thought because we were Germans, they wouldn't do anything. And it's a very strong culture. Yeah, well, it's a strong culture. And that,
their pride is amazing. My folks, my dad's first language is German, and his parents immigrated from Germany through Ellis Island separately, and that's here in the United States. So when you talk about, you know, the timing and the precision and the orderliness and the black and whiteness and stuff, I saw that in my father growing up. He still has all of that. He's still alive. And then to think that that's not just him, it's a culture, and it was a country, and it was a way of thinking. Because when I was in Germany, I was in Cologne, and there was a red light, and there were pedestrians, right, and we're waiting to cross the street. It's silence. There's no chit-chatting amongst anybody. And I look to the left, and I look to the right, and there is not a car as far as the eye can see. But that light is red, and that means it's verboten. You do not cross the street until that light is green. And I was thinking, what must the penalty be? Because it was all I could do not to just walk across the street. There's not a car for as far as you can see, but that damn light was red, and so I'll be damned if people didn't stay on the curb waiting for the green light.
Well, you know, Maria, on that note, the German society, certainly very authoritarian, and at the time anyway, and they did lots of experiments. You know, the most famous were done right there in California on authoritarian behavior. They were called the Milgram experiments, and they were done at Stanford in the basement of Stanford University, where they told people to shock people, and people thought they were really shocking them, and only one person in the whole experiment stood up and said, hey, this is crazy. I'm in the basement of the Stanford, you know, social science building. You guys can't make me do this. And he walked out. But almost every other participant in the survey did exactly what they were told to do, even though they thought they were killing the person that they were shocking. It was amazing. So, well, Ken, thanks so much for sharing your experiences with us. But we need to move on a little bit here because we can't have a guy like you on the show and not ask you, or I can't, what our president needs to do to fix his image. Oh my God.
Oh God.
The Boy Scouts, you know, there's
a saying I came up with a while ago, kind of like based on a Harry Chapin song, which is, once the ship hits the iceberg, the only thing the PR people can do is encourage the band to keep playing. You know, and you have to, I mean, if this wasn't so comical, it would be tragic. And it is. It is pure Shakespeare. Or somebody said, it's like The Godfather, except the whole Trump family kids, they're all Fredo.
Yeah, and exactly.
And, He's never had to listen to anybody in his life. I mean, right. and so somebody goes through that life without self-awareness, and that is the critical component in anything having to do with reputation, is introspection and self-awareness, and having people around him that will say no. And I think this path is going to continue. I wish the chief of staff well, but one thing that I learned when I was at the police commission, this was after the OJ thing, and I was trying to repair the reputation of the LA Police Commission, is that once people start leaking, then everybody starts leaking. And it's this weird socio-economic function that people go, I've got to now leak. I know something. I'm going to call the LA Times. I'm going to call the New York Times. So they've got a bigger problem than just making leaking illegal.
Yeah, I get it. Well, and, you know, I think it says something when you got to call the Marines in to straighten out the White House staff, you know. And General Kelly, I have great respect for this man. And I think he was a brilliant choice, you know, that Democrats and Republicans both admire him. Unlike the smooch, the first time I saw him, I was like, didn't I buy a used car from this guy one time? Yeah. So I never understood why you would bring him in. But Kelly, I certainly understand that. Ken, I'm sorry, Maria. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, because Ken has a wealth of experience with all different kinds of organizations, from for-profits and not-for-profits and nonprofits. And Ken, you're distilling all of that into this launch with your company. You must see a void or a niche that isn't being filled, and thus you've created this entity moving forward.
Well, there's two components to that answer, because I did have faith that corporations would care about their reputation, and that has been made very clear to me that it was not. A dear friend of mine was in a really bad boating accident, and he had a severe head injury. He was in a coma for 3 months. When he came out of the coma, his Visa card, the bank of his Visa card, they had canceled his card for non-payment, and he went through the process of showing them all the documentation and that he was in a coma and he couldn't, and he's single. And then he went and they closed his account. And he said, well, how do I get the account reopened? And they said, well, you don't. And he said, well, what about all the points I gathered over the years? Well, you lose those. And he went to the banking columnist for the LA Times. The LA Times banking columnist wrote the story, called the bank, and the bank completely said, we're not giving it to him, and that's just the way it is. And that changed my thinking about, are we really going to affect the way that corporations did, or is it about how we affect the way people see reputation? I was doing a lot of training for quite some time of executives and middle-level managers on their online reputation. And what I found almost to the person was people didn't really have an answer for the question of, you walk into an interview and they say, you know what, tell me something about yourself. And they're stunned. They don't have anything there, partially because they don't know what the question really wants. And what I've come up with, and I've done this where I've worked before with CEOs and management, is that developing your own brand as a personal brand to transfer to your professional career. And that really has, you know, it's a value-based brand. People will say, well, tell me about yourself. Well, I worked at this place, and this was my title, and this is what my job was. And if you're lucky, they may give you some statistics to back up the success. That's not value. That's what you did for them. That doesn't tell me anything. And the reason is because people don't sit down. We all know how hard it is to write our own resume. And part of it is because we don't take the time to think about who we are. What is it about us that makes us unique, that makes us valuable, that makes us something that somebody would like to engage with? And so that's a lot harder than just writing your resume. So I see these executives skipping over this step. And the outplacement firms, they don't have the time for it. I'm not sure how many coaches have the time for it. But before you proceed with anything, understand who you are. So when they say to me, tell me something about yourself, you can bring up something that is truly unique about yourself that they're going to remember when you leave the room.
Well, you know what I have a suggestion for you, Ken. I think you should hook up clients with politicians because we're great at personal hyperbole. We can exaggerate what we are to the point of you know, that people don't even believe it anymore. It's a skill that every politician has. But I understand what you're saying. Well, I think you're absolutely right.
But correct me if I'm wrong, though. Isn't that because they have consultants that tell them this?
Yes,
as opposed
absolutely.
To really digging into it and figuring out who is this person.
Absolutely. And they have people that actually do it for them. They generally don't do it themselves.
Yeah.
They have people that stand up and do it for them. So, but yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's very hard. I've been a fundraiser, political fundraiser for many, many people, but I have a terrible time asking people for money for myself, my own campaign. So, yeah, that's a very important point.
Since
most of us tend to think like corporate America or the resume versus the CV versus what headhunters are looking for, you're asking us really to think outside the box and get creative here. And I would imagine not a lot of people are capable of doing that, thus your company. But I would think if you had a questionnaire maybe that would help identify what makes you unique or what makes you special or what makes you different,
you could do it that way, but my experience has been you got to bang them over the head 300 times because you got to ask them the same question over and over again. You know, my dad was both a New York City police captain and a criminal defense attorney, and he always taught me that either in police or law, if you're not getting the answers, it's because you're not asking the right questions. And you have to remember that. It's the questions and how you ask them and getting people to get deeper into their world. What was it? Was there something in your childhood that changed things? Was there somebody in your family that influenced you? Who is it that made you where you are? What were the experiences that contributed? These are not yes-no answers or multiple choice. They've got to really think about this. And this actually started back in New York. I was about to go on a first date with a woman, and she called me up the night before the date, and in a typical New York moment, said, before I go out with you, tell me what your friends would say that I need to know about you. And I said that. I thought that was a great question, and I said, you know what? I'm going to find out, and I'm going to call my friends and find out. I'll call you back. And I did, and I called one of my closest friends, and I posed the question, and I got a response that has stayed with me today because it was a great question, but it made me think about that. And there's a Yiddish expression that says, don't judge a man by the words of his mother. Listen to the comments of his neighbors. So part of this also is engaging other people to say, is this, what do you think I am? Where's my value here? What am I? And it's not about tax completion or even intellect. It's about everybody has something really special about them that I believe that if you look deep enough, it's in there. Unfortunately, in this country particularly, they beat the creativity out of you, and individual personalities are looked down upon.
Right.
Let me ask you something, Ken.
Yeah.
What do you do about the culture, the corporate culture? I mean, how do you change that? In your visa example, this is the thing. I was in the communications business. I really hate this, companies that do stuff like that. And I remember my favorite case was a guy from the IRS that was on some news program one night justifying how the IRS had seized the babysitting money of some little girl because she had mistakenly put her grandmother's Social Security number on her checking account, and they were able to seize the money. And they put this idiot on there as this little blonde girl is crying. They put this idiot on there to explain why this is the perfectly legal thing for them to do. So how do you change that culture of bureaucracy that says, yeah, as long as we follow the rules, we don't need to think?
Well, there's a couple of things. In fact, this morning, CBS Sunday Morning did a piece on this, and one of the places they measured was Nordstrom. you don't feel that Nordstrom empowers their own people to take charge to make your life easier. Southwest Airlines, these are brands that are strong and are continuing because they actually do something completely different. They empower their people, and they don't go like you see other airlines dragging people out of the aisles and such.
Right.
So you have to look to these success stories. One of the challenges you have with that, Senator, is that the stock market's going so great. And one thing I learned really the hard way is the number one and number two and number three jobs of every single CEO in this country is to keep their job. And everything they're going to do is surrounding keeping their job. Not doing right, not doing great, but keeping their job. Because the pay scales are so ridiculous that why would they take a risk to change that? Now, you do have companies, like I said, like Nordstrom and Federal Express is another one where they really, you know, if you're unhappy, they want to know about it. But those are few and far between.
Well, Ken, we're running out of time here. Is there some way that people can hook up with you and get information? Do you have a website or something else that you would like to tell us about?
Well, the website is going to be up, and we're changing the website, but they can email me at Ferber, Ferber, at Truify, Truefy, Truify.net. And Truify is the concept that came from Shakespeare, to that own self be true. Ask yourself these questions, and this is what I'm going to be helping people do. And then once they understand that, then you can go on and write your resume or CV or whatever. But understand what eyeglass am I looking through? Who am I in that realm of, personally?
So I'm curious, Michael, based on what you've heard Ken say, might you change your approach for your next, say, re-election?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you mean by that, Maria. I've learned a lot over the years, but you mean, what do you mean? How so?
Well, what you've done has worked, and it's been successful, but what I mean can say is that maybe people don't know who the Senator Michael D. Brown is as a human, as a person, as a big-hearted guy, as a husband, as a father. They just might know what you do with your position and with the constituencies. And I'm hearing Ken allowing us to get to know you as a human.
Yes, and I try to do some of that, and I probably need to do more of it. And I also use it, just to be honest with you. I've got to tell you that I live in one of the best neighborhoods in town, and I live in a really nice house. And when I go into poor neighborhoods, a lot of times people will stand up and they'll challenge me. They'll say, that's easy for you to say, you know, because you live in this neighborhood, you live in a big house. And they're usually shocked to find out that I buried both my parents at 15, that I was an orphan, that I was a high school dropout, that I worked my way back into high school and through college. And you know what I mean? And I started a business that made me a millionaire on an $800 loan from my sister. So I use that too. Believe me, it's very effective. Those people that challenge you sit right down and be quiet after that.
And the reason it works is because that has shaped who you are. So it's not something extraneous. It was core to who your development is. And so people, when I tell people, reveal yourself, which is one of the words I say, reveal yourself, but make it to the point that it's actually relevant to what you're doing and what you're trying to do. So, you know, you have an amazing story. I think a lot of people have stories, or they have people in their family with stories.
I love what you're doing, Ken, because it's so, it applies to everyone, and it's so almost altruistic if you think about it. It's like you're saying, tap into your greatness and let people know. Mm.
And before we let you go, Ken, I got to tell this one last story because it's exactly this point. I help, as I said, train Native Americans. And I remember that we went, and the first thing we do is we try to get them to write a stump speech. So we give them the principles, and we had this woman from Alaska who was running for Congress. And we said, why are you running for Congress? And she stood up and she said, because I want to represent the people of my area. And that was pretty much it. And she sat down. Mm-hmm. But then after a week's worth of training and talking to her the way you want, you know, you say we should do it. She got up and told a story about how she went to get her seriously wounded son in Afghanistan, who was in Walter Reed Hospital for a year and a half, and how she held his hand for a year and a half, and she brought him back on a plane. He lost both of his legs and one of his arms, and how the soldiers hugged her and how they stayed in touch with her. I'll tell you, when she gave her speech at the end of the week, not one person in that room had a dry eye. And, you know, and that's what we tell them. Yeah, not just I want to, you know, I want to get elected because I want to help you. Really tell them why. Why are you motivated to do this? So, yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I hope you'll come back soon and let us know how your business is going. And, you know, to quote, since you quoted Harry Chapin, let me quote Jim. Let me quote Jim Croce, who said, "What we do is what makes us what we are." So we should always be in touch with that. And unfortunately for me today, Ken, we're going to close out with a song because this has shaped my life more than anything recently. Mm-hmm. This goes out to Mrs. Brown. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? By the Beatles. Thank you so much, Ken.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you, Ken.
I'm sure she will. Take care. And I'd love to come back anytime.
All right. Thanks.
And good luck with everything, Ken. And our listeners, have a great
week. Thanks,
Maria.
Thanks so much.
As always.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
See you next week, America.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.